Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Stepan Mestrovic. Stepan is, he's been on many times before. He's a professor of sociology at Texas A&M University. He wrote one of my favorite books, and we've discussed it on the program before. It's called The Good Soldier on Trial. It's a sociological study of misconduct by the U.S. military pertaining to Operation Iron Triangle in Iraq. Well, Operation Triangle, comma, Iraq. It's important because it really is one example of the war crimes that America commits in all of its wars, and they're all unjust, they're all illegal, they're all wars of aggression, and when you can take snapshots of specific examples of horrendous crimes that people at higher levels, the commanders, their commanders, right up the chain of command to the top, Joint Chiefs, Secretary of Defense, Vice President, President, nothing ever happens to them. Rarely does anything happen to anybody else. But once in a while when something does, it's lower level, usually the lowest level, soldiers, they get hung out to dry wrongfully for their superiors' crimes. That's why Stepan's book, The Good Soldier on Trial, is important, because that certainly makes that case very strongly. Oh, there's so much going on that causes me angst, Stepan. Maybe there's one thing in particular you want to jump into. I can certainly recommend a number of topics. Welcome.
Yes, thank you. Well, it's been a very tough Christmas week in terms of the news. I mean, you've got two diametrically opposed federal court decisions on NSA spying. You've had unrest in the Middle East. You've got riots in Turkey. It just goes on and on. I mean, there's no such thing as peace on earth. There's no feeling of peace on earth this time around, more so than before.
It really, peace on earth, Stepan, it honestly sounds like a sick joke. I can't remember a single Christmas. I wrote about one of note in one of my Christmas Day articles. Christmas period, not one day, but a number of days. I think it went on maybe for a week or two. 1914, months after World War One began, and Allied forces and German forces decided on their own, in opposition to their commanders, to call a Christmas period hiatus. And it was really astonishing. For a good period, they went out and they buried their dead. They mixed. I mean, they basically fraternized. I mean, they were shooting at each other the day before, and then suddenly they went out and they were fraternizing. They played football, meaning soccer, in Europe.
Right.
Can you imagine combatants on either side simply calling a halt to the fighting, going out and shaking hands? Together they bury their dead and having a friendly game of football. I mean, it's inconceivable today.
That's true. I mean, that's really remarkable. That's absolutely remarkable. I think along these lines there have been a lot of changes, sociologically. One of the things I brought up before is that during World War II, one of the things that's also inconceivable is how well the Americans treated the Nazi prisoners. You know, I talked about that, like at Camp Hearn, which is about 30 miles from here, where I am in Texas. The camp still remains, the remnants of the camp. And the Americans went out of their way to go beyond the Geneva Conventions and allowed the German prisoners, you know, within a prison, unbelievable freedoms, including, like you mentioned, soccer fields, soccer leagues, orchestra. They put on plays. They were allowed to have beer when that was, and sugar when that was rationed outside of the camp. So despite some horrific images that we have from past history, there were these moments, like you mentioned the one about, you know, World War One. There were these moments where people were able to overcome and genuine humanity to shine through. That seems to be missing now.
Oh, it sure is missing. I can't remember who was Secretary. There was no Secretary of Defense then. It was the Secretary of War at the 1945. I don't know who the Secretary of War was. I'd have to look that up. But, of course, we had Harry Truman and we had Dwight Eisenhower. I don't know what they did with the Japanese. We had Dwight MacArthur. And, of course, we had Nuremberg. which to me is so important. So not only treating combatants, which I mean most of these combatants didn't want to be there anyway. You know, they simply had no choice. It was either getting into the military or being shot or put in prison. So they literally had no choice. And, of course, the propaganda campaign that Joseph Goebbels explained, and I remember writing about him, Stepan, Hermann Göring, after he was in prison, before he committed suicide, he was interviewed by a prison psychologist, and the psychologist asked him, how did you ever convince the German people to go along with this stuff? And his answer was something to the effect that, you can't just haul them away and tell them you're going to go fight a war. You've got to convince them that their lives and welfare are in danger. You know, their families' lives are in danger. That's the only way you can get German workers and farmers and so on to want to go to war. You know, not to do it for Germany, but to defend their families. So the propaganda by Goebbels was intense, convincing people to go along. But I'm certain they were resistors, and I'm certain Hitler didn't treat them very, very well. In America, if you go to prison, in Germany you get shot or maybe tortured to death.
Mm-hmm. But I think also one of the changes is that in those times, the propaganda still had a sort of, how shall I put it, you know, emotional mean face. I mean, when we think about Hitler or Goebbels, those people, the images we have from television is, you know, they were angry, they were shouting, they were waving their hands, they were yelling. Kind of like, you know, they were not nice, if you will. The images we have today, and I think, and I've written about this, one of the reasons we don't have opposition to the ongoing spying and stuff that's going on now is that we put a nice face on similar kinds of propaganda. So our leaders are always charming. They're always nice. They smile really big. Everyone is always shown smiling, even when terrible things are going on. I mean, one of the things historically that is going to jump out as time goes on is that at Abu Ghraib, if you remember, the soldiers were smiling ear to ear in the photos that they took of each other as they were torturing people. So this whole idea about nice torture, nice propaganda, if you will, nice surveillance, that's something that I think would have been inconceivable in World War I and World War II.
Oh, I agree. I absolutely agree. And it reminds me of Bertram Gross's book back in the 1980s that he titled Friendly Fascism, and I've quoted it a number of times in previous articles, the idea that when fascism comes to America, which it certainly has, it'll be with a smiling face. So we have U.S. leaders like Obama, you know, smiling face in front of the public, a supreme con man, saying one thing and doing absolutely the opposite. Time after time after time, one thought that just popped into my mind, Stepan, recently he made a comment, and he certainly made similar ones before, that America's drone campaign only targets combatants, you know, the Al-Qaeda types, and it's an absolute bald-faced lie because there have been studies, including one I quoted by New York University and Stanford University, saying 98%, put it the other way, only 2% of those killed are what America calls high-value targets, and most of those high-value targets are Taliban or Al-Qaeda or whatever you want to call them, and the great majority of the other 98% are innocent, non-combatant civilian men, women, children, infants, the elderly and infirm, as I like to put it. Those are the people that are being murdered by American drones, you know, from 20 or 30,000 feet with some guy manipulating his computer keyboards safely away. It could be nearby. It could be 100 miles away. It could be halfway across the world. And when at the end of his workday, he just closes up shop, goes home to dinner, has dinner, goes out to a movie, whatever, and then goes back to the office the next day to do more killing. And he's killing civilians. And from 20 or 30,000 feet, you can't really see who you're killing, Stepan. All you do is you just push a button and you see a blip. And I can remember during the Gulf War seeing on TV where they showed pictures of an attack, not by drones then, that was 1991, not by drones, but U.S. aircraft. It showed the pilot homing in on a target and then shooting his missile, and then it showed an explosion, but you didn't see any people being shredded. You just saw some target being blown to pieces without any reference to the fact that there were human beings in there, including civilians, and they were blown to bits with the target that was blown to bits, or maybe it wasn't even the right target. That's what war is all about. So the idea of painting a pretty picture on it, there's nothing pretty about war, and there's nothing good about any war, including World War II. The sickening expression about that war, Stepan, the so-called good war, it absolutely was the worst one that ever was fought.
No, I agree, but as you know, the photos from World War I and II, they did show the bodies. It was enough to make people recoil and put into motion the Nuremberg trials and to put in more Geneva Conventions and so forth. But what's different now is, like you said, and I agree with you, we don't see the shredded bodies. But above all, the way it's all presented is in terms of security, in terms of, again, nice-sounding concepts. Even the genocide that was waged in Bosnia was not called genocide. It was called ethnic cleansing. You know, the word cleansing has such a pretty feel to it. Everybody wants to feel clean. Everybody wants to take a shower. That term was coined, ironically, even at The Hague, at the trials. They don't use the word genocide. They use ethnic cleansing, which, by the way, is not a crime. And so you can't even convict. So what we really are seeing is, in terms of propaganda, it's a very subtle shift into these kinds of nice phrases and nice euphemisms. And what that does is it takes away the power of opposition. Because very simply, you can't get angry at somebody who appears to be nice. It's much easier to get angry at somebody who is themselves shouting at you, yelling, or is not nice. So this idea, you know, of a cosmetic, manipulated kind of niceness is what I think sociologically is going on, and what, you know, at present we have down to a science, how to make very unpalatable, ugly things in war appear to be nice.
Oh, absolutely. You airbrush out the horrors of war. And I was never in a war, so I simply can't speak from personal experience. And even some people who are, they can be behind guns that can be miles from the front lines or in an airplane dropping missiles or bombs, and they literally don't see the human carnage below. So most people never get a close-up picture. You're right about World War. There was no television during World War II or World War I, but there sure was during Vietnam. And
right.
I mentioned several times in articles that Lyndon Johnson blamed Walter Cronkite for losing the war because every night he showed the images of the war in Vietnam. And
exactly.
The Pentagon learned a lesson from that war and U.S. TV covering it. Never again would they allow U.S. journalists free reins on the front lines to report exactly what was going on. So instead of having real journalists, we get embedded journalists. And Studs Terkel, former Chicagoan before he passed away a few years ago, Studs Terkel referred to them as, quote-unquote, in bed with journalists. And that's exactly what mainstream journalism is today. They simply don't tell the truth.
Right. And also, you mentioned the photographs and the video images from Vietnam. One of the things that's going on is, and you notice it, you never see images of dead Taliban in this war. They're completely sanitized. Even at Abu Ghraib, you know, there was a big ruckus because about 200 photos were leaked. Those were spread all over the world, but there were about 18,000 from that incident, 18,000 photos that will never be leaked, that will never be seen. But there's a complete censorship of these so-called collateral damage, which is another euphemism that we have. There's a complete censorship of the bodies and of the gruesome images, which I think if they were shown all the time, you know, people would become more engaged with the war, and there might be a chance for more opposition. So the censorship, that's one of the lessons apparently that's been learned from the Vietnam War, has grown much more sophisticated, and so much so that people are not even aware that it's going on. I mean, you hardly ever get any kinds of stories. You get a few seconds here and there about an American killed by an IED, for example. It'll last a few seconds on TV. But no images, no in-depth analysis, no context. So it's the censorship has again become much, much more sophisticated.
Boy, has it ever. And the mainstream media is so complicit in what's going on that, again, they simply whitewash the truth, and they report managed news information when they're not reporting entertainment or junk food news. And people following the mainstream, even in the New York Times, the major newspapers, they simply have no idea what's going on. And I must say, and I wrote about it recently, that listeners probably know that Amazon CEO bought the Washington Post, Jeff Bezos, bought the Washington Post. He paid $300 million for it. Well, apparently he got it very, very, at a very good price, especially because of what happened just recently that I wrote about. He got a CIA contract for $600 million. Now, can you imagine a major American newspaper in Washington, D.C., Bob McChesney, maybe the leading U.S. Scholar, media scholar and critic, calls the Post the most important political publication in America. And now we've got a guy who owns it, connected with the CIA. Well, you have to take everything written in the Washington Post, read it very, very carefully, and wonder just exactly what's going on. Is this the Post saying it, or is the CIA saying it?
Right.
Is it a CIA press handout, or is it an independent Washington Post report? You won't know, which means the Washington Post lost all credibility.
Right. Well, I'm sure you know that Noam Chomsky long ago wrote a book called The Manufacture of Consent.
Oh, yes, with Edward Herman.
Where he talked about how the government has basically infiltrated all the major newspapers and controls more news than the so-called news media does, you know, in terms of outlets and in terms of having planted journalists and getting permission and control. But again, I'm not sure, despite Chomsky's and other books that have uncovered these kinds of things, it just doesn't seem like, I know for a fact if I would talk to my students about this, most of them would not be aware, most of them would not believe it.
Well, it's amazing. I think young people today are overall stepping in much more savvy than many years ago in the 1950s when I was in school. Well, it was the end of World War II. I think we were all filled with the rubbish about World War II being a good war. I had relatives in the war. Amazingly, they all came back unscathed, so I heard no horrors about the war. My dad was in World War I. He never talked about it, and I never really asked him. It never was a subject of conversation at home, but he came back in one piece. So I never had a taste by knowing people or having relatives, with one exception I'll mention just briefly in a moment. But I had no concept that the war can cause so much harm to so many people. If it doesn't kill them, it can literally destroy their bodies and their minds or whatever. My best boyhood friend lost his brother in the war. He was very, very touchy about the subject even coming up, which I discovered. So I never raised it after doing it once and got him very upset. But an older brother, and we were kids then. We were both about 11 years old or so when the war ended. So his brother was old enough to go into the war. Certainly had to be a number of years older, probably at least 18, to be drafted into the war. I don't know where he, what the theater he was in, Asia or Europe, but he was killed. And my friend never wanted to talk about it. I had a neighbor who was a victim of a Nazi concentration camp, and he never wanted to talk about it. He lived right next door to me. He never wanted to talk about it, but he was different from the other kids. He was about my age. He was different from the other kids and was obvious, which I didn't understand as well then as I did later on, that the effect of going through that experience and surviving did a terrible emotional damage to him, because he absolutely was much different than the kids I played with. He never played with us. He was a loner. And you could see that his life was very, very damaged. I wonder what happened to him. I remember his first name, but not his last name. But amazingly, he survived, and amazingly, he was my next-door neighbor. So these were my two experiences with the war, but nothing else. The members of my immediate family, no problem at all. I never heard anybody say anything about the close calls they had or whatever. But war really is terrible, absolutely terrible. And World War II, nobody knows how many people died. It could have been 40, 60 million people. And most of them were in Soviet Russia, because they were on the front lines, and the Nazis put up about 3 million troops against them. And Stalin, just through humanity, he had plenty of weapons that lots were supplied by America, and lots he built way back far distant in eastern Russia, far from the front lines. The Nazis couldn't quite reach them with long-range aircraft. So he produced a lot himself, but America supplied lots of arms and munitions. And Russia, or Soviet Russia, with all the republics, had lots of humanity, and he just threw bodies at the Nazis. So I don't know, millions of Russian combatants died. They were more weapons than they were people. But Russia played a great role in defeating the Nazis. But they did it at a very, very great price. And it took many years for Russia to come back and be a normal country after that. and America lost, never had a bomb dropped in its territory. The only war that really harmed America, Stephan, as we know, was the Civil War. And in terms of lives lost in proportion to the population, if I remember the number correctly, that I compared it to American losses in World War II, which was deaths, which was something like 365,000. And I think it was about 600,000 in the Civil War, but a much smaller population that would have amounted to something like 12 million lost American lives.
I think that's about right.
An awful lot of people. If 12 million were lost in World War II, and the population then, I'm sure, was less than half of what it is today, that would be the equivalent of, say, losing 25 million people today in a war. Pretty awful.
Right. You know, there's a great irony here. I think you're right from everything I know and have read that in your generation and certainly in the previous wars, people were more private, and that was just the way they were socialized. They didn't have Facebook. They didn't have the idea about spilling one's guts out about anything, whether it was something very tough or even, by the way, about love and marriage. You know, it was something, those things were considered very private. We now have, you know, in this social media age, people post everything on Facebook, you know, what they're eating, who they're with. They take photographs of themselves at different places. In schools, they're expected to put their artwork up on the wall. When they're at home, their artwork is put up on the refrigerator. They're used to, as a whole population, they're used to all just sharing everything. But it's a great irony that despite the technology and this movement towards sharing, you know, we have this word sharing that's just embedded in our culture. The vets who are coming back with PTSD, and we know statistically that they are there. I know they're there from my previous work with vets, and also because, you know, I have some in my classes. They don't share. So it's, again, the media, even though it has the technology to allow them to talk about these experiences in a way that would not have been possible in World War I and II, is not doing it. So, you know, there's a great irony here. There's something going on. Again, I think what's going on is that the whole culture is built towards a culture of fun and niceness. You can see this even on the news. I mean, you mentioned Walter Cronkite. That was just, he was a serious guy. Basically, he got on, and for 30 minutes, you got straight, serious, sober news. He did not banter about with other people on the stage. He did not bring in fluff news. He did not, talk about the weather or any kind of fun stuff. It was just, he was very serious and grim and did the news. Now, no matter what network you tune into, it's always a group of them. They're always joking with each other. They're always bringing in, at the same time that they're talking about serious things, something about squirrels or about a cat somewhere or about a human interest story about a child. It's all mixed in. And in this, again, this culture of fun and niceness, it's very hard to focus in for young people today on something serious like PTSD or the ugliness of war.
Well, again, that's so true, and I've written a fair amount about what has happened to U.S. servicemen who fought in Iraq, who fought in Afghanistan, in other U.S. wars, just post 9/11. The PTSD alone is absolutely horrific. The effects are devastating. The fact that so many soldiers come back, combatants come back, including women who may not be on the front lines, are deeply affected by this, by what they've been through. Just the physical harm, the emotional harm, and the percentage of them that are affected is absolutely astonishing. I mean, enormous numbers of people are so gravely harmed, and they get very shoddily treated overall when they come back.
Right.
Oh, they can't be totally ignored, but they simply don't get the care they need. And it's disgraceful. I mean, they've literally ruined their lives. I mean, World War II basically ruined a generation of young people, young men, for the most part. But they were treated very well when they came home. I think they had the proper care. We had the GI Bill. There were wonderful things done for the returning vets. And today they're simply spurned. Promises are made and promises are broken. And the worst ones are the fact that they don't get the medical care, emotional or physical, that they need.
Right.
Or basically anything else. They're just thrown away like, production inputs used and dumped when they're no longer needed. And they simply get more cattle fodder to replace
right.
them. That's the way America fights its wars today.
No, I agree with that. I've had some vets, students in my classes, and I can tell you almost all of them have had tremendous problems, you know, in terms of attendance. They get in trouble with the law. They have trouble concentrating. I mean, they are definitely the problem students. And I've talked to some of them, and when they do try to get help from the Veterans Administration, they've all complained about the bureaucracy, about waiting for years to see somebody, about not getting funding or payments for the treatment. And again, as an issue, it comes up once in a while in the news. You get a few seconds where they talk about how the VA administration is still not computerized, how it's still antiquated, it uses paper files which are not filed properly, that, you know, there's just months, even in some cases years of backlog for certain cases to get treated, but nothing seems to happen. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that.
And you never hear anything about this in the news, Stepan. Again, this stuff is just airbrushed out. So, and
right.
The wars, it's almost like a computer game. The little gets reported, very little gets reported about Afghanistan. Nothing, except, well, almost nothing about what's even going on in Iraq today, where most people have no idea that Iraq is still a war zone. There
right.
are literally dozens of people being killed every single day. Car bombs, other attacks, all over the country. And virtually nothing reported, nothing on TV. Once in a while, the New York Times or another big publication might have a story about it. But they don't tell what readers really need to know. I mean, what they really need to know is America waged an illegal war of aggression. It had nothing to do with removing a dictator. It had everything to do with controlling the country and its resources, its oil and its gas, and having another foothold in the Middle East to establish more U.S. bases to go after other countries in the region for their resources and to build more U.S. bases, and the same thing in Afghanistan, and the geopolitical interest, which means that targeting any nation that would stand as a potential challenger to U.S. global dominance. And the final two in the line of America's struggle for absolute dominance are China and Russia. So America surrounds both countries with U.S. bases. They put up so-called defensive missiles that have nothing to do with defense and everything to do with offense. And these two countries are very angry about it. I mean, they're not going to go to war with America. They're certainly able to defend themselves if America attacks. But this is the way America treats other countries and fights wars literally nonstop. There literally isn't a moment. There has never been a moment in my life that America has not been at war with one or more countries. Literally, not a single moment, not a day, every single day, direct wars and or proxy wars. And even when World War II ended, the proxy wars continued until Harry Truman's illegal aggression, and I emphasize the illegal, against North Korea, that had nothing to do with starting the Korean War. It was America goading South Korea that started the Korean War, and the history reports it upside down. And, of course, the Vietnam War, Cambodia, Laos, Southeast Asia in total, again,
right.
Illegal war of aggression. On and on and on, Panama, in 1989, George Bush Sr., Reagan's... Grenada.
Right.
Sending the U.S. Marines with the Chicago Police Force could have done the job very nicely against a non-belligerent country on false pretenses. And, of course, the Central American wars, the Contra wars, and others in Salvador and Guatemala and the rest of it, and just horrendous numbers of people killed and harmed. And on, post 9/11, things got worse than ever, and that's the way the situation is today. And it'll get worse. I expect a new war breaking out in 2014. I think Syria will be the next target. Obama got called down, and he had to back off, but the plan is still to depose Assad of Syria. And if America can't do it one way, it's going to do it another way, and then Iran is in the line of fire. And this is longstanding U.S. policy. Get rid of all independent governments, replace them with pro-Western puppet states, and the millions of people you kill, a small price to pay. That's the way America feels about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really hard to add anything to that. I mean, it makes sense.
I think we're coming up on a break. It takes all the joy out of Christmas, doesn't it, Stepan?
I'm sorry?
It takes all the joy out of Christmas.
Yes.
It really makes a mockery of the joy that's proclaimed over Christmas when people are dying every single day because of what America does. Let's hold that. We'll come right back. We'll take a break. Stay with us. Welcome back. Talking with Zeppelin Mechtovic. So much going on in the world that really caused so much harm to so many people, Zeppelin. Anything else on the top of your mind, world events, national events?
Well, I want to put a sort of sociological perspective on what we've just talked about. One of the things, again, from World War II that's interesting, despite all the horrors, and it was horrible, is that afterwards there was a Marshall Plan, and there was a concerted effort for America to rebuild its enemies. And one of the consequences we still have today is that our biggest enemies, that's Germany and Japan, are today our friends and allies. And there's a sociological principle here that ties into the Christmas season. There's a wonderful little book called The Gift by Marcel Mauss. It was written in 1932. It's quite old. But the principle is anytime you give a gift, you're creating a social bond. Because when you give a gift, it can be a tangible gift, a kind word, a warm gesture. You also are planting an obligation to repay the gift. It's a huge human principle. It's been around for thousands of years. You can see it at work in World War II. What strikes me as just incredible is that in the big picture today, we don't have any of this sort of gift-giving on a geopolitical level. There's nothing like the Marshall Plan today. There's absolutely no effort to build these kinds of social bonds with our enemies, to sort of bury the hatchet and to go beyond war in terms of, you know, giving something so that you give them an obligation to give you something back, which is a much more powerful principle in human interaction and war. So, you know, it's just very striking. One of the things I mentioned before, and again, I want to tie it into this gift giving, is in World War II, by treating the German prisoners so well, I mean, with this book that document this, the Germans were startled. They expected to be tortured in American prisoner of war camps. They weren't. On the contrary, they were treated well, and it left a deep impression on tens of thousands of them. When they went back to Germany, they came back liking America and Americans. So you changed, you know, an entire generation's perspective from all that propaganda by Goebbels and so forth that you mentioned earlier. So it just seems to me that we're lacking any sorts of alternatives to war and more war and constant war, which you had mentioned earlier. And I find that startling.
It really is startling, and we're both old enough to remember back in the 1960s and 1970s that overwhelming opposition to the Southeast Asian wars finally got Congress to act. It certainly didn't act quickly. It took years before Congress, with better people in it, some people like Frank Church, William Fulbright, people like that of that stature, and we simply don't have those kinds of people in Congress today. But it took literally, I mean, the anti-Vietnam War protests began, say, in the mid-60s, and they lasted the better part of a decade, and it took until, I recall, I've mentioned this so many times in articles, it took until April 1975 before the final U.S. troops were airlifted off the roof of the Saigon embassy out of the country as the Vietnamese troops stormed through the gates, literally stormed through the gates of the embassy.
And I remember. It was a very dramatic footage. Yeah.
Oh, indeed so. Indeed so. And covered on TV. Covered on the kind of stuff you'd never see today. And but it took very, very strong protests to finally get that war ended. And we had a little bit before the Iraq War in 2003, but it dissipated. And we Americans are fed up with war, as a poll show, but we certainly don't see people out in the streets with boycotts. We don't see academic boycotts. We don't see any kind of boycotts. So literally, the powers that be, Congress and the administrations, whether it's Bush or Obama, they can keep waging these wars. And they're spending hundreds of billions of dollars every year doing it. And this is money that should be directed toward doing constructive things at home. And instead,
exactly,
it goes to killing.
And abroad, by the way, again, and abroad. I mean, one of the things about foreign aid is it does build goodwill. So you're right, America's infrastructure certainly needs that money, but I think that money can also be put in much more constructive uses in building friendships abroad. So none of that is happening. But also, like you say, what's amazing is that there's no opposition, no real concerted opposition like there was in the 60s.
It really is very disturbing to me. I don't know what it would take to get people upset. Of course, they have other things on their mind, like the terrible Main Street depression, economic depression, and that's bothering them. But it still amazes me. Why can't people connect the dots? Instead of money being spent the way it was done in the 1930s to create jobs with government projects, building infrastructure and so on, that really cut the unemployment rate dramatically, the money is going toward militarism and giving bankers and other major corporations handouts. Trillions of dollars being spent on this. And I wrote an article a couple of months ago from 1996, if I remember the date, until either 2011 or 12, something on the order of $8 trillion was either wasted or stolen in military funding at the Pentagon. Down a black hole in the Pentagon, maybe, is the best way to describe it. $8 trillion, with a T, like Tom, $8 trillion down a rat hole in the Pentagon. And just imagine the good that kind of money could do. My God, I mean... We probably could end poverty, and certainly in all of North and South America. We could put every kid in school. We could provide universal health care. We could have a wonderful country, and we could spread some of that wealth to other countries and help people abroad. And again, instead, we use this money to murder them and to destroy countries, ravage them, and control them, and then on to the next country to do the same thing against. And this is the true agenda of America. It doesn't matter whether you've got a Republican or a Democrat in charge, in Congress or the White House. They both follow the same script.
Well, when we do have little outbursts of opposition like Occupy Wall Street, that was immediately mocked and nullified by the media, by the mainstream media of all things. So in some senses in the 60s, the media took the sides of the opposition, of the protests. But you've got the media today that when there is an attempt made to somewhat replicate what was going on in the 60s, they take a pro-government position. That's one of the factors, I think, that has to be factored into this as an explanation.
Yeah, again, very, very true. And where do you go to find just a foothold of institutions of people who are willing to come out and take a stand against the stuff going on? And an article I wrote about the American Studies Association supporting an academic boycott of Israel, a very courageous stand. It was only the second American U.S. academic association to take a stand against Israel from an academic point of view, Israeli academic institutions, not the staff or the students in these institutions, colleges and universities, but the institutions themselves. And I must say, I'm writing an article about opposition. I mentioned it to you in an email, Stephen, today. I'm writing an article about U.S. universities, including my own, very, very opposed to this. And in some cases, making very, very strong statements against it, you know, compromising academic freedom and so on. What rubbish. Absolute rubbish, because it has nothing to do with compromising academic freedom. But I literally didn't know. I suspected and had kernels of information, but in researching my article, I discovered that for a good deal of time, virtually every major Israeli college and university, and a good many I never heard of, and I stopped counting how many, but I've got it all documented, and I named about a dozen of the universities, including a few I knew nothing about, but major ones like Haifa University, Tel Aviv University, Hebrew University, Bar-Ilan University. These are big institutions in Israel, and they're all very, very tied in to Israel's military complex. They have high-level military commanders and security officials on staff teaching or coming to the classrooms and maybe giving a guest lecture or something or other. They're very tied in with Israel's military agenda, and it really is shocking. It's almost like they're a platform for the horrors that Israel commits against Palestinians and other nations in the region when it decides to go to war. Lebanon in 2006, previous Lebanese wars, the Six-Day War in 1967, which has been mischaracterized as Israel defending itself. It was well-planned Israeli aggression, and of course the 1948 war. I guess there were no universities in those days, but Israel's so-called War of Independence, that was the worst one of all. Well-planned in advance, literally scorched earth, what the Palestinians call the Nakba, where 800,000 or so people were either murdered or displaced, and their land was stolen. And then in 1967, the little that remained, the West Bank and Gaza, East Jerusalem, they were stolen. And the universities support this kind of stuff, and they do it. They do it pretty openly, and I didn't know it, and there it was. A lot of information. I couldn't get too much in it because I would need to write a separate article about it, but I got enough information in my article that I'll put out tomorrow that shows these universities and colleges are in league with Israel's worst crimes, and it's about time somebody said something about it. And for these colleges like Harvard and the University of Maryland, University of Indiana, I quoted their presidents, and other major ones, Yale, Princeton, in Chicago, Northwestern, University of Chicago, New York University, a couple of others in my article, literally supporting the worst of Israeli crimes and claiming that what the ASA, American Studies Association, is doing is a violation of academic freedom. It is not. It is not. So they not only got it wrong, but they lied about it. And I have to wonder, Stepan, do they really know what these Israeli institutions are doing, the support they're giving to Israeli militarism and wars and the crimes that are committed? Do they know nothing about it? Maybe they don't, because I didn't know as much a day ago as I know now.
Well, you know, you're talking about the Israeli situation, but I think if you poked around just simply on American universities, not in relation to Israel, but just in relation to the American Department of Defense infrastructure, you would find something very similar. All the major universities in America are pushing getting federal grants because that's where they get a lot of their money to supplement and offset salary costs and so forth. And most of the federal government grants, to get them, you have to take a position that's basically supporting the status quo. They're not going to support a grant that would investigate, for example, how to foster opposition to the war, or, you know, something that would be more in line with the 60s. Instead, no matter what field, from engineering to psychology, they support grants that basically support interests. For example, psychologists are very heavily tied into interrogation techniques. You know, you get funding for that. So you've got an entire infrastructure, I think, even in the United States, that's basically geared towards a pro-government agenda.
Yeah, you really do. And it's amazing how the powers that be have literally built this infrastructure with academic institutions, with think tanks,
right,
with other organizations, all tied into this military-industrial complex. The worst offender of all, in my mind, are the major media, because they're, you know, that's where most people get their information, mostly on television, and you simply cannot watch a U.S. television so-called news broadcast without getting absolute rubbish information. You certainly don't get the truth. And when you're not bombarded with nonsensical news, junk food news, entertainment stuff, really silly stories that have no place in a newscast, you're getting propaganda, or you're getting nothing at all about the worst policies of the government. So all of this gets swept under the rug, and they continue. And then you get Obama's smiling face saying one thing but doing absolutely the opposite. And I've written enough about him alone, Stepan, I would say, to fill a few books easily. And I have to imagine that maybe some of his people have spotted some of what I write. And I also am absolutely dead certain that the NSA and CIA and FBI have growing files on me. I guess the NSA just has me in electronic files. And, well, it's all electronic. But the FBI and CIA, I guess they have their own files, however they keep them. And you can get printouts, as I understand, if you want to pay for them. They pay for them page by page. You get them heavily redacted, so you don't know what the heck. The worst stuff, they won't let you read. But I imagine they keep close track of me. But I make it easy for them because everything I do is out in the open.
Yeah, I mean, that's very disturbing. But in general, you know, it's again, we have to sort of pinch ourselves and ask, you know, are we sort of in a twilight zone when you consider, I mentioned earlier the psychologists. It's quite remarkable. They had some, you know, 10 years ago, there was some infighting at the American Psychological Association as to whether or not they would support some of these so-called research into interrogation techniques. But the very phrase interrogation technique, like we discussed in the first half hour, is a euphemism for torture. Again, you sanitize it, you airbrush it, you make it seem nice. You know, interrogation technique just sounds wonderful. Something you'd see on TV, and it's, you know, to serve security ends and so forth. But it ends up being torture. And even though they were debating it and they were split on it, a large number of them, I mean, this is easy to verify, you know, joined. And they're the ones that supplied the research for how to break somebody down in terms of isolation and stress techniques and so forth. And it's all tied in together. It's all, like you said, to the military-industrial complex in terms of how the university is set up, how it wants the government funding for research grants, and then how the various professors at various universities sell their souls in order to participate in these programs.
I didn't get that back in college, but I must say when I was back in school in the 1950s, undergrad and grad school, well, grad school was business, so everything was the business curriculum. Although when I took a course of money and banking, they taught me everything other than what they should have taught me. It was the worst course I took. Absolutely, stuff that as soon as you memorize it and took an exam, you forgot about it. Lots of charts and graphs and tables and formulas and stuff. It taught me nothing about money and banking. I had to learn that on my own, and certainly nothing about the Federal Reserve, which is the most important thing. Which the Federal Reserve, it isn't federal, it doesn't have reserves, and it's controlled by Wall Street. Nothing like that was ever brought up in my classroom. But back in college, there was only one professor I remember who was absolutely wonderful, and a man named George Wald, and it was in a required natural science course that I took.
I took a course from him. He was incredible. He was an incredible guy, Nobel Prize winning biologist at Harvard.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well, then you knew him the way I knew him. I'll never forget. I took a course with him in fall 1953, spring 1954, my sophomore year. And I still remember one dramatic thing he said in classroom, and I think I could quote him verbatim to this day, where he said, "There is, quote unquote, there is no such thing as safe nuclear power." I mean, that statement stuck with me all through the years. It's when people knew nothing about nuclear power, the idea that nuclear radiation kills, and he knew it, and he made a very strong point saying it. And the rest of the course was, you know, the science that he had to teach. It's a shame he didn't get into some of the political issues, but that's not what he did, and he won a Nobel Prize later.
Right. No, but he did take political stands. As you know, he sided with the students in a lot of those protests.
Oh, yeah. No. Oh, yeah. So, later on.
Yeah, that's right, because I caught him later on towards the tail end. I was there in 1972. He was still there. So, yeah, you're right. But I think when you're talking about being at Harvard in the 50s, that was the beginning of the military-industrial complex. It wasn't as developed and as sophisticated as it is now. And there is no such person like a George Wald who would stand up like that today. I mean, not in any university. And again, I remember Wald had a phrase for that, too. He said, even way back then, he said professors are too busy, as he put it, polishing their own buttons. That's the phrase that he used, than taking principled moral stands. Well, I think what he said there is even more true. Polishing one's buttons is one's career. I think that's even more true today than it was when he said it.
Oh, absolutely. I once tried to contact his wife. He had already passed away. And I forget who recommended that I do it. It might have been Francis Boyle, who recommended that I contact his wife to invite her on this program. And she was getting up in years, and he gave me an email address, or the last one that he had, and I emailed her, but I could not connect with her. He said that she was very much cut out of the same mold as George was. Had George been alive, he would have been an absolute marvelous guest. There was another man I had at Harvard freshman year, political science. He literally taught the most popular course on campus, a political science course, and his name was Sam Beer. And I'm not certain if he would have supported the same things we're talking about, Stepan. But he was in Nazi Germany during the 1930s, and he absolutely despised Nazism and fascism. And because of that, I wondered whether he might be a marvelous guest. He was still alive when I began hosting radio, but he was well into his 90s. And the only thing I learned after he passed away was that he was lucid until the end. And I think he lived to about age 97 or so, or pretty close to it. So he would have been a marvelous guest. And I wonder, had I known that, or known how to reach him, whether he would have been willing to come on, and whether he would have been a marvelous guest, because I'll never forget him. He was a very, very dramatic lecturer.
Yeah, well, as we're talking about this, I mean, there were so many figures from that whole era at Harvard. David Reisman was another one of them, one of my teachers, and he spoke out very vehemently against the war, and also against nuclear power, and the dangers of nuclear weapons, just like Wall did. So you had an entire several sets of generations there who were exposed to professors who not just talked about the subject matter, but who were willing to talk about moral, social issues and do so very openly with the blessings of Harvard University. And you have to scratch your head today. I mean, you don't hear any such voices today coming out of there or other similar kinds of institutions.
No, you sure don't. Francis Boyle, who's been on this program a few times, law professor, University of Illinois down at Champaign-Urbana, and we communicate a lot with each other, and he went to Harvard undergrad, I believe Harvard undergrad, but Harvard law for sure, and he rails against the law school and the kind of professors who teach there, like Alan Dershowitz, who's retiring, and he pulls no punches. He's marvelous, absolutely marvelous. And in the article I'm writing on the American Studies Association, I'm quoting a letter that he wrote to the president of Harvard, polite but very critical about her support, her opposition to ASA's academic boycott of Israeli institutions. So this is what Francis stands for. And he absolutely is appalled at the kind of people who teach at Harvard, war criminals, or people who support war crimes like Alan Dershowitz. I wonder what the undergraduates get these days.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question, but from what I know about the sociology department, there's nobody there of the stature, the deep, thought-provoking, grand scope that David Reisman had. Absolutely nobody. Mostly they're just number crunchers and just very narrowly focused. I mean, that whole era of big-minded, big-picture, again, being concerned with moral issues, professors, I think, has gone. And I think that's one of the huge factors as we're sitting here trying to explain some of these changes. I think that's one of the big factors. The academic leadership has just dissipated.
Oh, it really is. It's very shameful. And the two names that pop into my mind who I took courses with, I took a course with George Homans.
Yeah, I remember him, too.
Do you remember him?
Sure, of course.
And Clyde Cluckholm, anthropology.
Mm-hmm.
He would come to class dressed like he just came off the Indian reservation he was studying, which I loved. And instead of being a stuffed shirt with a coat and tie on, he came in literally like he came right off the reservation. And he was marvelous. I loved him for that. And he was a good teacher. And smoking was in vogue back then. The thing I remember most about Homans was he chain smoked all the way through his lectures.
Right.
What a way to teach.
But you know, you went to business school. One of the things that disturbs me is that universities are increasingly they're taking on the business model instead of the liberal arts model. In other words, we are, as professors, I can tell it in my career as a professor, we are much more monitored, beset by bureaucracy, by all kinds of administrative measuring of everything, you know, how many pupils we have, and what grades they get and attend. I mean, it's becoming much more regimented. It's a matter of counting. It's, of course, for the university, it's a huge matter of counting profits and money. The whole idea of having small seminars, which was, at the time you and I went to college, was, you know, considered okay, that's frowned upon now. You're supposed to get as many students packed in there as possible to bring in huge profits for the university. So increasingly, it's happening slowly, but you can see it year by year happening. We have fewer professors, much larger student bodies, and much more pressure to basically, just like in a factory, just get them through so we can make a huge profit for the university. And at the same time, we're expected to bring in massive federal grants. And there's a lot of pressure on that in terms of promotion and in terms of getting good ranking. So the whole emphasis is away from humanistic liberal arts kind of free, expansive thinking towards a business model of kind of like working at McDonald's, you know. What's the bottom line? How much money are you bringing in? How much profit are you making for the university?
Oh, absolutely true. I mean, I think the main job of the university president is to raise money, and academics is a distant number two responsibility.
Right.
Stephen, the hour passes much too fast. I look forward to getting you back again. We covered a lot of important ground. We will do it again soon, and I'm sure we'll have lots more to talk about. Many, many thanks. And a happy New Year to you.
I enjoyed it too. Thank you. You too. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen. Join us again tomorrow. We'll be back on with more important discussions. Make it a regular habit.